Denizens of the internet, hello and welcome to Rack Addicts After Hours, episode 41. My name's Ben. I'm joined by Pete, Luke, and once again, from the deepest depths of the warp of time, Andy has returned to us. Hello, Andy.
Hello,
I've missed you.
Hello. How you doing, mate?
So much better to have you here.
I'm excited.
In a park in the middle of nowhere with a suspiciously warm wall. Weekly catch-up. But Andy, for you, it's probably more like...
Three months?
How long?
At least, yeah.
Too long. So, get started. Catch us up. What's been happening? Burfield, life?
Yeah, tons.
Burfield, life and lockdown. That's going to be your memoir.
Yeah. Just ticking away, man, to be honest. Just working at the studio, working at our shop, trying to navigate all of the crazy stuff that's happening at the moment. That's really been it. I mean, without going into like too much detail to bore everyone.
Now Kieran's sort of focused in other places. You're the main audio man.
Yeah,
it's all your baby now.
It really is. Yeah. So I mean, that's been really cool. Kieran's like doing his media thing, which we spoke about, which has given me a little bit of time to sit down with the studio and kind of work out what we're going to be doing, and again how it all looks after. Well, I say after all of this crazy stuff, because we're by no means toward the end of it. I've had a brain fart.
Well, that's what you get for leaving the podcast.
Yeah.
You get dead air and we can just stare at you.
Yeah, keep it in for sure.
I hope you enjoyed that silence.
In my brain, it was just...
The cogs ticking over. Well, I'm very happy to have you back, and it's gonna be great having access to you
to my brain,
whatever that means. But yeah, hopefully you'll be able to stick around for more episodes.
I certainly
back
hope
to
so.
How it was in the olden days.
That's the one. Try and get rid of that dead air.
What about you, Luke? How have you been ticking over?
I'm well, thank you. I've had a fairly uneventful week, although we had some good news on the band front. We got played in America today on Amazing USA Radio, who I am now aware of. And, I'm very grateful
you mean,
for them.
You mean you've been a long time fan?
Indeed. Very grateful for them to playing our track Rendezvous, which of course was mastered by the magnificent Burfield Studios.
That was something I did.
Yeah. There you go.
Come on, Andy, you've got to remember what you've been doing.
I think we've been keeping you quite busy, haven't we?
Oh, yeah, but it's been good stuff, man. I'm so excited for it.
Yeah. Cool. No, we appreciate
that. Can you spell rendezvous for us, for the listeners, because it's not spelt how the normal word is spelled, just so they can take a listen themselves.
I think the main reason behind that is because none of us in the band could really spell it particularly well. So it's spelt as it sounds, ron-day-day-vu-voo.
Excellent.
It's so appropriate as well, because there's like so many ways in my head to say it.
Indeed.
Like when you go and sit down and do it, but I personally got the, it's rendezvous.
Well, yeah, exactly. And when we put it on the board, when we had our, we've got a little whiteboard, we're very organised, you see, in our little studio, and it was covered in all the song ideas and so on, and I wrote rendezvous, you know, rendezvous.
Rendezvous.
And it just didn't, no one liked it. So yeah, we called it rendezvous, because that's how you say it anyway. I mean, this is one of those things where it's probably an old French word that's been incorporated into English, and no one really knows why or how to say it or spell it, so why not just spell it like that?
Yeah, there are so many words like that that are English, but then you pick up and say, oh no, that was definitely French at one point,
or Latin or something long gone. But yeah, that's kind of it. I've had a fairly nice and chill time, really. Yeah, just been looking forward to getting back to the podcast. There's been some cool space news, which we'll come to later.
Yeah, I, the non-spacey man, heard some space news. So I'm excited to hear your take
on
it.
I've heard something spacey as well. I don't know whether or not we're going to talk about it.
I wonder if the news segment I've picked, because I was forwarded a very interesting one, but then I had to take on the new one.
The new one. So I think it's probably the new one that I saw.
We'll see.
We'll tickle that one later. But Pete, what have you been up to?
Right, I've been fighting my perpetual foe, writer's block.
Oh, yeah.
So in an endeavour to do this, I picked up a copy of Scalar 2. I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with that.
No,
the Plugin Boutique.
Yeah.
So Scalar, or Scalar 2, which is the version I've got, is an application which you load as a plugin into your preferred DAW.
Yeah.
It does come with a very small library of sounds, but that's not its primary purpose. Primary purpose is to give you... I'm using it for sort of music theory, but what it does is if you want to play in some notes into it, it will tell you, if you play a succession of notes, it'll say, this is the key.
Yes.
It'll interpret it. So it's a tool whereby it can listen to MIDI. It can also listen to audio and tell you what key something's in. But let's say you can either put in a chord sequence yourself, and then it will, you sort of literally go get a pull-down menu, and it will change all the voicings.
Mm.
And it's got all the voicings. It's got all the keys. It's got everything in it.
It's
like a complete music sort of theory thing.
I think I saw it. Did it have like some artist presets in it as well?
Yes, it's got. So
is that the one with MJ Cole's presets in it, or am I?
I'm not familiar with that. It might be. That's so okay. Loads of artists have submitted their favourite chord sequences.
Yes.
So you could, you know, there's a particular one, or if you want, let's say you want, okay, let's have a chord sequence in B flat minor, and in a different set of voicings as well. So it will just do it automatically. So you can just drag and drop. You've got various boxes for each chord, let's say, and you can just drag it down and you can build up chord sequences. But the idea is to get out of that loop, and we've all discussed it before, the situation whereby you're just playing it, you're just always working in the same key, you always end up playing the same. I'm trying to break out of my bad habits, basically. It introduces you to a new chord sequences, new voicings of familiar chord sequences. It's just got a lot of scope to it. And then once you've done it, it will actually record the MIDI, and you can then drag and drop the MIDI into the MIDI lane, or a MIDI lane in your DAW.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's an interesting tool. It costs, I would like to say, £49.99 English pounds.
Ooh, tempting.
And I've been haunted. The reason I was aware of it, I mean, there was a... quite a few that seem to come up in my YouTube stream. You know, as you're watching stuff, I mean, obviously the algorithms know the sort of things you're potentially interested in.
The algorithms know.
And this one was
everything.
Particularly haunting me. I mean, this version has been released for about 3 months, but over the last 2 weeks, the advert for it had been haunting me. And the more it came up, I sort of thought, maybe
got you,
I should
Pete.
Do.
Yeah,
so I actually I went and got it. And initially I thought, I think I've, what's the refund policy? But then I persevered a bit more, and I'm thinking, no, actually, this could be quite useful. So that's what I've been doing, digging in and trying to write some new chord progressions, new chord sequences, just some fresh stuff that's outside my normal repertoire.
Yeah,
nice one. It's one of those kind of programs or tools that will let you channel your that one particular Brian Eno quote, where he's going on about how it makes the issue of music composition not one of talent but one of choice, and having good ears for it. So you don't have to be an incredible pianist to get some nice lines in. You've got to know when it's right.
Well, I think that's the case, because I think there's been a lot of examples of that over history. There was a Eric Satie piece that I was learning a few years ago. And Eric Satie was one of the French romantic composers.
Gymnopédie, that's one of my favourite songs
by
him.
So,
I think that's him anyway.
Yes, yeah, so... he was regarded by his tutors. He was one of the conservatoires in Paris, and he was regarded as not a very good pianist. And he ends up being a world-famous composer. So it's not always the best musicians.
Yeah,
And I know a lot of really accomplished musicians, but they don't compose music.
Mm.
So I think even if it doesn't really necessarily... It does help if you're, you've got a very good technique or you're very talented.
Mm.
But in the same respect... It doesn't mean that you've got necessarily a good discernment of, a good melody.
I know what you mean. When we've had like session musicians up, for example, and they're really accomplished, but sometimes you find that they just play and their technique's fantastic, but that's what they do. They're just really talented at being able to sit down and play the piece that they're given. But no ideas. Then you come across an artist, as it were, that would come in, and they might not be the most accomplished guitar player, but what they're playing really, is creative, and it's something that speaks to you.
And then, as Ben said, quoting the Brian Eno, it is a process of selection, even if you're playing it or you're selecting it from something. And if we refer to something like modular, you play around with modular, and if you record anything, it's a process of selection, because a lot of times modular, it's really experimental. You don't really know what you're going to be getting.
Yeah, if you're using a tool like the Turing Machine or the Melodicer, or
yeah, certainly that's exactly.
What was that other one called? Was it Metasonics?
The Omsonic.
Omsonic, yeah, yeah, that one. That the name escapes me.
Or with the dice button on the wave state.
Yeah, yeah,
it's all the same thing. It's your selection or your retention of the bits that you feel have got value or quality, and hopefully or potentially, if you've got good taste, let's say, other people are going to appreciate that selection.
Yeah, certainly. And when you think about it, all you're doing is using just another tool that you're given to create music. The end product is still the same regardless, whether or not you could play
that
insane jazz chord or whether or not you press the button and it triggered the chord. You've still heard it and it still means something to you.
And I maintain at the end of the day, for most listeners, they really have got no concern about how the music was created. They just listen to it for what it is. I mean, obviously, if you're a musician, you may be listening to the kind of music you're listening to. You're listening to technique, especially obviously Telma's not with us this week, but if you're into jazz, I mean, knowing quite a few people that are jazz musicians or into jazz, there's a lot of appreciation of technique, if I want to say. I mean, there's a lot of consideration about the technique, and especially when they're listening to it, they're also listening to the technique. And certainly with certain types of jazz, it's very show-offy in that respect.
Yes.
It's not necessarily very melodious, but it's very show-offy in respect to technique.
Yeah, we've had a weirdly inspirational opener to the podcast this week. I like it. Let's jump into something less inspirational and more factual, but equally exciting to me, at least. Arturia, we knew about this a little bit earlier, but Arturia have now unveiled the Polybrute. Actually, I was bored at work the other day when this was embargoed. That could apply to any day of my week. Anyway, so I was just kind of Googling. This is before there were videos up and articles and things. I was just Googling Arturia Polybrute. And there were Gear Sluts threads about this from about 2018, I want to say. So there was a very vague picture of this. It's been in the works for a very long time. But six-voice Arturia Poly. And it's got so many of the now classic Arturia features. I know people were thinking they might not have the Steiner Parker ladder filter that's been in Mini Brutes 1, 2, Micro Brute, Matrix Brute, because I think there was a concern about noise or something. But we've still got the dual filter and master cutoff thing of the Matrix Brute. We've still got the standard Brute oscillators with the wave folding, three envelopes, three LFOs, mod matrix. It's pretty cool. And we've got a ribbon controller, which is apparently a fashion these days, and something that looks a little bit like the Expressive E Touché controller. It doesn't wibble from side to side, but it is a touch XY pad and the pressure thing. So lots of expressive options, and the demos are good. The Sonic State one, some of the presets. Well, that was just a preview, really, but some of the presets sounded great. As always, we recommend you go and watch the Mylar Melodies video, which I think was released today, because he's always super thorough and has a little bit of a different point of view from most people, so you get a bit of a different angle. But the cool thing about this one is the A-B morphing. So you can have two patches active at any one time, and there's a really interesting way of blending from one to the other. So let's say you've got one of those presets where you're all sawtooth oscillators, the other one is all square wave or something. You can kind of blend through from one to the other, which gives you some interesting expressive options. It sounds really cool. There's not really anything else about that's going to do that, unless you're talking digital, in which case digital can do anything really, can't it? But no, this one looks really cool, sounds cool. It's obviously going to be built well because it's Arturia. Any vibes from you guys? I know, Pete, you will definitely have had a good look into this one. Either of you run across it?
Yes, it makes me very glad that I didn't buy a Matrix Brew.
Ah, yeah.
Because I've only had to sell it and get this.
Yeah.
I am very interested.
Ooh, dangerous.
Yes, I mean, and I watched the Sonic State demo, and it's kind of got everything, because it's got ambient and it's got real
beastly,
bottom end.
Beastly
bottom
blows,
end,
yeah.
Isn't it? It's got that kind of classic Arturia sort of brute sound to it.
It's great because they've carved out that niche for themselves. Really, there is a definite sonic character to their stuff. It's great. So it can be super metallic if you want it to be, with sort of the metallizer on the triangle waves, but equally polite, should you so desire.
Yes, I mean, do we know when we're going to actually see any in the flesh.
We've heard late October, but you know, who knows?
Well, I hope they've. There's not a delay.
Mm. Are you itching for one already?
Well, no, I'll wait till the customers have all had theirs.
That's so kind.
Yeah. Well, that you know,
it's not really our choice.
No, customers come first in that respect. But
make sure there are no weird issues with it on the ones that we sell first before you make up your mind.
I've never really known much problems with any of the Arturia stuff. It's not one of the ones that you see, there's another one that's come back.
The only repair I ever remember was like a broken micro USB port, and that's just because it's a micro USB port and they had it for a year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I certainly don't recall any of the Matrix Brutes having any issues.
No, the only thing that could possibly disappoint me with this one is that they didn't go for the hinge top panel like the Matrix Brutes. I just love that form factor.
No, but it made it... Until the Moog One came out, it almost made it the heaviest synth known to man.
Well, you did have a bit of an accident with your back and a Matrix Brute, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I attempted to lift one. That was the. It was extraordinary.
I do remember when the Matrix Brute first came out and getting it out for a demo, and I looked at it and I was like, explicit. It's just a big thing.
It's so cool.
But that hinge top, it just added so much weight because it had to be stable, so it just added so much metal and the hinge.
Two
and
layers of steel so underneath, all this kind of stuff.
I don't think this needs it, to be really honest.
But I want it.
Oh, right. And it's only going to add more cost.
I mean, is it going to be the same
but
size?
But I want it, Pete.
But just look at the Sequential Pro 3.
It does add a good chunk.
Yeah, it does add a lot of more cost because it's got to hinge up whilst maintaining the interface through to the key bed and so forth.
Yeah. So not quite as deep in terms of size, but probably as wide and as much metal.
So what's that? So 61? Is that even bigger? How many octaves?
That's 61.
Yeah, 60. Actually, potentially wider, to be fair, because the Matrix Brute isn't a 61 key.
No.
It's going to be a chunky
one. It's going to be a chunky boy.
Eventually, it might turn up with a hard case like the Matrix Brute does now.
It's a thick boy.
Does the Matrix Brute turn up in a hard case?
It does now, yeah. I don't know if it's a special edition.
It turns up in a hard case?
Yeah. So
they must hate us.
The one we've got in the shop at the moment, it's got a nice wheeled, like, tweed flight case.
Now,
it's really, really fancy.
That's part of the deal with them.
It is now. Certainly the modern ones, yeah.
Because the box was seriously substantial. I think there was two boxes. There was a box within a box.
Yeah, with those like semi-cardboard wood type, you know, those corner kind of brace strips and really dense foam.
It was a serious piece of box.
Yeah, not like the Moog One box, which says two-person lift only.
Yeah, that's taken the mantle of the heaviest synth in the world.
Yeah, that's chunky. But the Moog packaging is really like underwhelming for what it is.
Do you know, because when it's nice when it's one of the smaller ones, you're like, yeah, this is good, and it's some nice foam. But then when it's
then you spend
really big,
$6,000 on it, and it's like, here's your carpool.
And some, it's nice foam, but like it doesn't feel anywhere near as substantial. Look how sad we are talking about the quality.
I was literally
packaging.
Just thinking that in my head, and it's like, oh yeah, that foam just really isn't what I wanted for my thing.
There's something to that. Though.
On a side note. In a little bit of news, little bit of gear.
Yeah.
And it's the Telega Audio Creme or Creme.
Creme.
And the packaging for that, first of all, I should probably say the unit is absolutely fantastic. It's a mixture between a Poltec and an SSL compressor in stereo, which is always a recipe for success. But the packaging is absolutely brilliant. I found out that because they're a German company, and because they have manufacturer on it, it means that they have certain kind of requirements that they have to meet. The packaging.
What do you mean?
I don't know, like in depth, but there are for them. I think in Germany, I might well be wrong. It might just be marketing, but for them to have like a Telega Audio manufacturing, they do have to meet certain requirements.
Okay.
But the packaging itself, it comes in like this wooden box. You imagine like kind of opening it up and you'd find like a lot of old school rifles. And it should have like straw inside it, and you lift it up. It's so, so good.
Yeah.
So sometimes packaging can be exciting.
Very exciting indeed.
I really like it.
Lovely stuff. Well, there should be a few more demos of this one popping up. But yeah, keep your eye on it. It's going to be a pretty nice synth. Well, I think you know that means it is time. Time now for Luke's Spacey Bit. delicious. Take it away.
Hello.
This is the first time Andy's heard it in person.
It's so good.
It's amazing.
And I was trying to work out whether or not that delicious was part of the recording, or you just saying it.
It will be now.
Excuse me, what recording? We just travelled to space, as you could tell by Ben's voice.
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, there's that cat.
There you go. Thank you. Well, after that brief interruption. So,
I'm so sorry, Luke.
Terribly sorry. We have to go with the most interesting piece of space news that perhaps the media has ever got a hold of, and that is there life on Venus?
Oh, cool. Yes, it is the thing I thought
that's
of.
That's what I was hoping.
To be honest, I saw the headline and went, nah, I'm going to wait for Luke's spacey bit. So what's the deal? What happened?
Well, about 3 years ago, a group of researchers at the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope, which is in Hawaii, it's a very big telescope, which measures sub-millimeter wave bands of light.
You can't do that with a very small telescope.
Indeed. Well, you could. You just couldn't separate them out or tell much about what they tell you about things.
Yes.
Hence big telescope. Hence big telescope, indeed. So, they took a long, hard look at Venus, and they noticed that certain wave bands, certain things were absorbing in a way that would be consistent with evidence of a chemical called phosphine, which is phosphorus but with an I-N-E on the end because it's surrounded by three hydrogen atoms. And basically, this is interesting because phosphine, the big headline is that essentially if you're going to have quantities of this gas and the quantities that they're seeing present on the surface of a planet like Venus, or the atmosphere of a planet like Venus, the implication is that it's probably caused by something which might be alive.
Ooh. Phosphine, I was reading about it, it can be manufactured.
Indeed.
But it's typically found in a biological sense. I remember, like, something very crude, I'm sure.
So phosphorus is, a chemical that is abundant in life. It's something that you'll find in the human body and in any sort of situation where life has arisen from some sort of soup or complex of molecules. Mm. And the reason why phosphine is interesting is because essentially it's a gas that contains phosphorus and it's potentially constructed by as a byproduct for certain chemical processes that are involved in respiration, possibly on an alien world or so on. So it's interesting because they sort of had to look at this and wonder what could be causing that. They had to check their results with another set of data. What they did was they, rather than publishing 3 years ago when they had these interesting results where they measured all this phosphine gas, they ran the results through another relay called the Atacama High Altitude Relay, I think it's called ALMA. It's a big old array of huge satellites. Looks a bit like SETI, if you've seen SETI before. The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
I know what it is. I haven't seen it.
It's you know, like in Independence Day and all the sci-fi films, you've got the big dishes.
Yeah.
That place. ALMA looks a bit like that. It's another huge radio telescope.
Atacama's a desert somewhere, isn't it? Mm.
It's Atacama desert.
It's big and it is sandy. That's where it is.
Interesting.
Perfect place for massive dishes. Mm. So they double-checked all the results with that, got some higher-grade resolution imaging on that, and they'd spent another couple of years basically just going through all of those results and trying to narrow down what could possibly explain the presence of phosphine. And they essentially ruled out quite a lot, which is why this is newsworthy, because it isn't a guarantee that there is life on Venus. There's absolutely no reason to think of this as proof. Mm. But the list of things that it could be is suspiciously short, is what they're getting at.
Yeah.
So they ruled out what they call general thermodynamic processes that can cause phosphine to be generated. They ruled out lightning strikes on Venus that could cause phosphine to be created. They ruled out volcanic activity and tectonic events, and also delivery by meteor.
Delivery by meteor, that's great.
I'm not sure how they worked that one out, but apparently they've accounted for it. And the amount of phosphine that they've seen, it's not a lot. It's something like, it was a very small amount in the parts per billion. Mm. But they say, it's way more than should be on there if they take into consideration all these other things. So this is a bit like when we were talking about the sunspots and so on. It's a good opportunity to sort of, it's good science in that this is going to inform a lot of future research efforts. We should probably send spacecraft to Venus to harvest bits of the atmosphere to have a closer look. Mm. And that has been done previously, and that's the fun thing.
That stuff terrifies me.
Fill me in on Venus, because since leaving school, I can't remember anything about
it. What's it like? Am I taking a holiday to Venus anytime soon?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because that's what page two of my notes says.
Oh, great! Look at him, he's so prepared, I love it.
Should Andy go on holiday to Venus?
Well, yes. You probably will want a refund, though. Unfortunately, you won't be able to claim said refund.
Oh, it's a you have to quarantine when you get back.
Yeah.
Because you'll be dead.
Extremely dead.
dead to the extreme.
So the average temperature of Venus's surface is something like 462 degrees centigrade.
Toasty.
I'm not sure what that is in Kelvin or American digits, but there you go. It is the atmosphere is primarily carbon dioxide. It's about 96.5%. Now, we've got a great deal of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, but if I remember right, our split is something like 70% nitrogen, 30% CO2, and then little bits of oxygen and everything else. Mm. Oxygen, actually, surprisingly, isn't the majority of our atmosphere. Oxygen, I think, makes up something like, 10 or 12%.
That was one of those terrifying facts that I heard. If there was more oxygen, like, you'd light a match and the world would explode.
Exactly, yeah. Which, and basically, that's what used to happen, is that, you know, the sky was on fire until it all burned out and eventually settled and cooled and water appeared and life appeared and the Cambrian explosion occurred.
Love that video. Yeah.
There's life in the ocean.
What? So
something's alive in the ocean. Anyway.
Thank you, Bill. So Venus is not fun to go to. Oh, and the pressure on the surface is apparently about 92 times that of the pressure on Earth now, where we sit, so which is roughly like sitting in the Mariana Trench. It's a very nasty place. We have sent things there, particularly the Soviets sent a lot of things there.
Oh, those crafty Soviets.
They really, really wanted to go there a lot more because essentially they, not to put too fine a point on it, but they didn't get to the moon first. They did take the first images of the moon, and they did do a few other firsts, but they didn't land on it, obviously, famously. But they are the first nation to put a lander of any sort on Venus, and one that worked. The problem is it's really hard to send anything back, because as soon as you kind of get on the surface, you imagine the pressures we're just talking about and the temperatures.
Yeah, getting back off again.
Well, that and also the cameras don't survive. The microphones don't survive. None of it works for very long. And one of the other difficulties they had was having the orbiting relay craft. So they would send a sort of two-piece mission.
Oh, yeah.
A satellite, essentially, and a lander. And the lander would be this kind of ball of iron, basically. You should look up these pictures. It's called Venera, which is essentially just Russian for Venus. Mm. The Venera missions, and then it was shortly followed by another series of missions, and the name escapes me. I didn't write it down. But they are a very interesting set of landers. They look great. It's that proper, like, classic Soviet engineering, all big, round, curvy, weird, strange things, like, you know, that sort of atomic era, very different to American design and what we're used to nowadays. So I encourage you to look at that. It was Venera 9 and 10 that successfully landed first on Venus in the 70s, followed by Venera 13, which sent back the first color video and audio recording. Now, you can see that video on YouTube, but there are a lot of fakes, and a lot of people say that the original audio has been lost. So whether or not that's the actual sound of Venus is another matter. But basically, you can't go there. It's bloody horrible. I wouldn't recommend it. However, life could exist on water droplets in the atmosphere, which is where we think this phosphine might be coming from. It's and again, water really is quite scarce on Venus, so we're looking at a chemical that appears in minute amounts in the parts per billion. But there are water droplets in the atmosphere, and the theory goes, proponents of life on Venus say that if life were to exist, it would be bacteria living on these droplets, spores, floating between warmer droplets as they sort of rise through condensation and then drip back down, and moving between them. So that would be basically the most advanced life that we think could occur on a planet tumultuous like that. There's a lot of plans to kind of go there in hot air balloons, which would be cool.
Space hot air balloons.
Yeah.
Doing the round the world in 80 days kind of vibe.
Yeah, but on yellow clouds. That'd be really cool.
Which is there was another planet that they were saying, other than Mars, obviously, with the possibility of having life. It was because as it orbits, it kind of squishes and then opens back up.
It might have been one of the moons. Enceladus is a big candidate for it.
Moon of Jupiter. Although there's a few to choose from.
So they were saying that there was theoretically an ocean beneath the ice that as it expands and goes.
Europa and Titan and I think Enceladus as well are big candidates for that sort of thing. Mm. So we're Previously on Rack Addicts, we mentioned Dragonfly, which is a mission that's going to go to one of those moons and fly around. It's basically a quadcopter, but it's enormous. Okay. So that's quite cool.
Which, of course, you listened to, didn't you, Andy?
What's this?
That says it all.
How could you? Traitor to the cause!
But there is a note of caution to this little tale about Venus. Essentially, Venus was... much like Earth, they think... Well, this is the thing about life on Venus. We don't know, per se, if life evolved there, which would be interesting. Mm. You know, another instance of life evolving in our solar system would be a data point of more than one for the origin of life. That would be very exciting. Mm-hmm. What's more likely is that life, bacterial life of some sort, was delivered to Venus, perhaps on an asteroid collision with Earth many, many millions of years ago when we were forming... pre-Cambrian explosion life and so on, or possibly the other way around. Maybe Earth was seeded by Mars or Venus back in the day. These are some of the big questions we want to answer by going to planets like Mars and drilling deep, deep, deep down and seeing stuff.
Using a phrase like back in the day in relation to space is fantastic.
Isn't it? Back in the celestial day. Yeah. A long, long, old time ago.
That's a good album name. Back in the celestial day.
Yeah.
Nice. So that's the big space news chunk.
Yes.
Any other little bits and pieces kicking about?
Well,
just tackling the big one.
Just the big one. I admit I didn't have as much time to put into this week as I normally would have done. But I saw this and I had to go for it. So yes, we are looking at possibly life on Venus. It's not proof, but it is interesting, and we must find out, because what could be more exciting than stellar neighbours?
Anything's more exciting than what's happening on Earth right now.
Indeed.
That brings us to the end of our timetabled subjects for the day. That means we've got to round off this evening, as it's becoming difficult to see the detail in each other's faces in this field in the middle of nowhere. YouTube recommendations. We always do round off our episodes like this because we do like to give you more options of things to spend your time doing if you're still, if we get locked down again, if you're furloughed, if you just want some things to take your mind off the world in general. Who's got one lined up and ready to go? A bit of YouTube for us.
I am ready to go.
Ooh, fire away, Pete.
Right, this week, one for the Trekkies.
Ooh. Ooh, that's not me.
Okay, sorry.
It'll go over my head today.
Okay, so this channel is called Star Trek Continues. So what it is a group of people over the last, I'd say, five years or so, might be slightly longer than that, and they've actually finished and left the evidence of what they've done on YouTube. And there's also a website, but I would imagine the videos on there link back to YouTube, or that's where they've been hosted, or they could be hosted elsewhere. So what they decided to do with their own money, and they also crowdfunded this, they initially started by rebuilding completely the original 1960s sets for Star Trek, the original series.
What, just scratch building the whole...
The whole lot.
Cool.
Exactly the same. And then they continued by creating another whole series of Star Trek episodes. And very faithfully, they've obviously got different actors playing the various characters. But notably... I'm not aware of the main characters playing Spock or Captain Kirk, but the gentleman playing Commander Scott or Scotty was actually the son of James Doolan, who's the original actor.
Amazing.
Who played
cool.
it. So it's his son playing it in this. The other actor, notable one person that everyone may know, would be...
So Don't hate me.
The actor that plays Sulu was Grant Imanara from Mythbusters.
No
who
way.
Unfortunately passed away last month,
yeah.
I would say very prematurely. So, yes, he played that particular character. But, yes, it's obviously been filmed on modern equipment, but it really looks like the old series. It's got that sort of slightly... camp look to it or feel to it in the respect of everything. They've got characters that resurface from the original series.
Dusty Super 8 style camera work.
Well, no, it's pretty sharp. And I mean, there's all the Star Treks, including the sort of the 1980s and 1990 versions, have all been sort of enhanced and digitized and improved. I can't remember which company actually owns the rights, but they. got the original series some years ago, and they replaced all the graphics with the shaky models, and they replaced them with computer graphics. But they didn't go overboard. Mm. They kept the style, but the planets look a lot more real and nice. Things like that. So that the you can still see versions of the really old 1965. I remember when it first came out. Unfortunately, version. But if you want to review it, it's the new digitally enhanced version you want to see, which is made it all much crisper. But yeah, I mean, there's a whole series on there, and there's quite a few videos on the channel about how they made it. It shows them building the sets, and there's lots of appeals to the various crowdfunding runs they did. And yes, so Star Trek Continues is my recommendation. Nice.
Sounds like a labour of love, that one.
Yes, it's certainly for them.
Yeah, nice one. Anybody else lined up and ready to go?
I have one.
You're far away.
So this is one I've mentioned, I think, off mic before, and it's quite a good laugh. It's called the All Gas, No Breaks Show.
Ah, yes.
If you haven't watched this, I mean, I don't really want to spoil it for you. It's just give it a watch. It's it's basically this chap goes around interviewing people, usually at strange or interesting events, and it's all gas, no brakes, frankly.
How about if you can't spoil it for fans of?
Well, it just makes it makes absolutely no kind of he doesn't put words in people's mouths. He just kind of goes to these quite strange events, or in all respects, quite simple and normal events.
Well, they just he sort of lets them talk themselves into a hole.
Yeah, it's quite. I'm thinking of. I want to say like Josh Keller or something like
quite
that.
Quite possibly.
Tall dude with like a sort of swept back hair.
Yeah, that's it.
It's similar to that, but I feel like that one had a bit more of an angle. This the All Gas No Breaks Show is quite well cut together, very tidily edited. All the chap really does is just sort of seek out certain individuals and just kind of say, "Hey, what's going on?
Okay,
what you doing?" And it makes for some uncomfortable or hilarious watching.
Okay.
So I thoroughly encourage you to watch it. He's been to Burning Man. He's been to bike shows. He's been to all kinds of things. He's been to probably my favourite episode. One of the hardest ones to watch was he went to a porn convention in LA, which was interesting.
Nice.
That might have to be cut.
Conventions.
But he went to several conventions of sorts. It's quite a funny show. Yeah. I would recommend the All Gas No Breaks Show if you're in for a laugh or a cringe.
Nice one. Well, as nerds, I think we're all aware of the YouTube general internet phenomenon of setup tours. We've spoken about this before because we all like a good picture of someone's rig, a setup, like gaming setup, studio setups, this kind of stuff. Imagine it's going to be the same for cars, bike enthusiasts, and to take a brief aside to make a bit of a joke, you're all familiar with the phrase somebody wears the pants in that relationship.
Yeah.
Well, in my relationship, I wear the secateurs, so I'm deeply comforted by my houseplants. I've mentioned my bonsai thing last week, and what was a revelation to me recently is that there are houseplant tours on YouTube. Uh-huh. So you can tune into somebody just taking you around their,
like a rig rundown.
It's a
bonsais.
Rig rundown, not even bonsais, but just plants, like houseplants. So
amazing.
They invariably take you through their front door, crib style. And it's like you walk into a jungle. It's amazing, like hanging plants, and it's just all green. And it's kind of a combination of that and sort of they got a bit of a hoarding problem.
So idyllic.
But it's great, yeah, because I do love just sitting looking at my plants. It makes me feel very relaxed. Nice. So if getting out in nature is not accessible to you at the moment, actually, you can't quite get it. But there's a little bit of comfort to be had in watching houseplant tours as well. Often the people hosting these are a little bit the hippie kind of type, but they often have very relaxing and calming voices as well. When they take you through to their yoga yurt.
Could you imagine
to
the
show
opposite?
The plants that are in there?
Hi, look at my plants.
What super high energy. I just can't get enough of these plants. Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my YouTube recommendation, is just look for houseplant tours. It's great.
That's cool.
Andy, just you left.
Just me.
Have you got some YouTube-y internet recommendations for things people should just check out? Because this is how this podcast works, if you remember from a long time ago.
From
a galaxy far, far away.
I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah, I'll beat you to it.
That's okay. Yeah, oversimplified history is okay. One of my favorite things. I can't believe I didn't talk about this when we were doing this beforehand, but basically it's it's just taking all of these grand events in history, like it's typically wars, to be honest, like World War One, II, the American Civil War, all kinds of things, and it's explained in a really comedic way, but with like a lot of facts as well. It's like, how do you say, you know when you kind of watch something and you get like that nugget of information that you don't necessarily realize that you like watch the thing for, but just for some reason it's absorbed in your brain?
Mm.
I've got that now with like all of these really strange facts about these historical events, but it's like overlaid in a really comedic, cartoony way. What was the Cambrian explosion?
the Bill words. Yeah.
If you,
all those little bits from
if
his...
If you like that,
things, yeah,
then you totally like oversimplified history.
If you want, now you can eat sunlight.
Using a revolutionary new technique, taste the sun.
that would be my recommendation. It's not quite as glorious as that one, but it's like you learn some stuff, you have some fun, and you just relax and watch that.
Oversimplified cool. history.
Oversimplified. I think it's just oversimplified, but you'd
okay.
find it.
Yeah, nice one. Well, thank you everybody for listening to Rack Addicts After Hours. Once again, as always, we would urge you to like Rack Addicts UK on Facebook. Tell your friends if you think they would like this podcast as well. Take care of yourself, and please tune in next week.